Today on the 21st, we're revisiting conversations about notable people who died in 2020. First, the life and legacy of former Illinois Governor Jim Thompson from the perspective of those who served with him. Then we'll talk with David Franklin, who was a law clerk to Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg in 1999. He's presently a professor of constitutional law at DePaul in Chicago and also served as Illinois Solicitor General. And finally, singer-songwriter John Prine was recently named Honorary Poet Laureate of Illinois nearly 3 months after his death from complications related to COVID-19. We'll speak with a biographer about how Prine's life in Illinois inspired his songwriting. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on The 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, and WNIJ in DeKalb. Now news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. This week, we're continuing to revisit highlights from our shows over the past year, and as we prepare to begin a new year, we wanted to reflect on some of the men and women who died in 2020. Later this hour, we'll hear from a former clerk to U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who himself has gone on to be a notable lawyer and professor in Illinois, and we'll talk about musician and honorary Illinois Poet Laureate John Prine. First, though, Governor Jim Thompson died August 14th at the age of 84. Known affectionately as Big Jim, he was 6 feet 6 inches tall, he remains the longest-serving Illinois governor, serving 4 terms from 1977 to 1991. We spoke with 2 former members of the Thompson administration. Karen Witter was assistant to the governor for natural resources, and former state senator Kirk Dillard was legislative liaison for Governor Thompson and now serves as chairman of the Regional Transportation Authority. Here now is that conversation. I guess I should just begin by saying, Karen and Kirk, to both of you, my condolences. I know you worked closely with him for a long time. Karen, can you begin by telling us, what was Thompson's campaign style like?
Well, there was nobody like Big Jim. And what I would say about him is he was so gregarious and he was so comfortable around all kinds of people. In any kind of a crowd, he would want to talk to people. We've heard a lot about him with the union workers on the grounds of the mansion, but he was equally comfortable engaging in a conversation with the Nobel Prize winner and artisans and all kinds of people. I would say that he had a really big tent.
You know, we've actually got some tape of Thompson in an interview for an oral history project with the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. Here he is talking about some of those interactions he had with crowds.
They took pictures of their kids standing next to me year after year in the same spot, in effect using me as a giant measuring stick to show how their kids had grown. And they put these cards up on the mantle, or these pictures up on the mantle in their houses. And the other thing that the crowd did, mostly younger people, would be to hand me beers. And I'd march down the street and I'd take a swig of beer and I'd pass it off to Skillbeck or one of the crew. And then people would give me another and another and another and another. And so by the time I got through with that parade, I was pretty well paraded out. But the affection, you know, that you get from people like that, it was extraordinary.
The dangers of campaigning and accepting beers on the parade route, I guess. You know, he was also known when campaigning for doing a sort of, I guess nowadays we'd call it code switching, right? He grew up in Chicago, but when he went to Southern Illinois, he sometimes deployed a drawl. And we have another, just another little bit of tape. Let's listen to this NPR report from 1978 by Scott Simon.
He was the obvious Republican possibility for governor last year, but some Republicans wondered about his political instincts. Those may still be uncertain, but he became a superbly successful campaigner with a trial lawyer's instinct for immersing himself in the idiom of his audience. WSSR in Springfield taped Mr. Thompson addressing a revival meeting in Southern Illinois, replete with Southern accent.
We've had too much of that kind of promising politics. Promise us a road, promise us a lake, promise us a bridge, promise us a dam, Promise us everything. Promise what you think we want to hear. And then
and WBEZ in Chicago taped Mr. the future House governor speaking of his rivalry with Mayor Daley to Southside steelworkers.
So the reason Daley wants to whip me is not because I'm a Republican, but because I was the guy that stood up and said, hey, enough is enough. And I don't mind they're saying what they're saying. I mean, he wants to call me Nixon's prosecutor, okay. He wants to, you know, yell about the case, it's okay, because nobody believes it anyway. You know, for him to say that and then just not prove it, bullshit. You know, he meant what he meant. Well, that's the part I don't like.
Yeah, everybody's gonna make your staff.
Okay.
It's not really a conscious thing. It's a sense of being at ease with people, I think. And if you're at ease with people, you pick up the mannerisms which they reflect and which surround you at the time. Nothing wrong with that.
So, Kirk Diller, did you ever hear Governor Thompson, you know, talking one way to people on the south side of Chicago and maybe another way in southern Illinois? Was he that way with lawmakers as well?
Well, he was a master chameleon in a very good sense. It was funny. The Peoria Journal Star had a story last week about how Governor Thompson, with students at Western Illinois University, where I attended and Karen's husband attended, and I was there when I saw Jim Thompson maybe drink out of a toilet plunger peach schnapps. He was amazing. He would work parades both sides of the street, and then he would work them backward as well. And he would usually wear a Walter Payton jersey if he was in the Chicago area when he campaigned. And he was a master. I mean, he was a great trial lawyer as the United States attorney in Chicago. You have to remember he was a law professor. This is a national public radio station broadcast, but Jim Thompson was a tremendous criminal law professor that wrote one of the largest selling criminal law casebooks in history. And, he was great. And again, this is an NPR station. One thing that Jim Thompson did that Governor Edgar did it as well, but Jim Thompson was a regular on college campuses. I mentioned I saw him at Western Illinois University. In fact, I first met him at Western Illinois University when he was young and skinny in 1976. He was campaigning, but he was at the U of I frequently. He would put on war paint when it was before it became politically incorrect to do so. He was there for the Beckman groundbreaking of the Beckman Institute. I was with him at the Rose Bowl in Pasadena when he went out and met with Mr. Beckman, as well as his wife, Mabel, and they ate peanut butter sandwiches. And Jim Thompson brought back millions of dollars with President Eikenberry of the U of I to create the Beckman Institute at Illinois. You know, the Farm Aid concert, who could forget that at the U of I with Willie Nelson and Neil Young and John Cougar Mellencamp. And then one of the things, and maybe it was Karen that wrote about it in a nice piece she did, or it could have been Steve McClure, who used to be head of the Business and Economic Development in Illinois. But Jim Thompson, when we didn't win the superconductor, super collider contract from the federal government, got Leon Letterman, a Nobel Prize winner, and we created a thing called the Illinois Coalition so that we could better compete as a state for federal research grants and economic development money. And Jim Thompson in the 70s and 80s was really focused on science and technology. And those are things that sometimes get overlooked when they talk about how he kept the White Sox in Chicago, or he had the vision to expand McCormick Place,
right,
or really turn Navy Pier from a decaying thing that stuck out in Lake Michigan into the state's number one tourist attraction. And Jim Thompson was a U of I student at the old Navy Pier in Chicago.
Well, Karen Witter, you mentioned that. You know, Thompson is known to have a better record on the environment than many Republicans. Let's talk about some of these policies. Why do you think that was?
I think what's remarkable is when you talk about the different categories of things that Thompson did, he had so many significant accomplishments in so many different areas. First and foremost, what strikes me about Governor Thompson is that he was smart and he listened to a lot of people. And when one time Mike Witte, who was the director of the Department of Conservation, came into the office and he said, I've just promised the environmental community that we're going to have a meeting with Governor Thompson. So We have to make that happen. Well, this meeting turned into a 5-hour meeting with the governor listening to presentations by the environmental community about all kinds of issues from solid waste to groundwater protection to recycling. And the fact that he was willing to listen, he invested money in natural areas acquisition as part of the Build Illinois program. So as there were programs that related to economic development, there was also a piece related to conservation. And I think he had very wide interests. He was interested in cultural resources and the arts. And I think that he really did see that the environment, the arts, all of these things enrich the quality of life. And if you're going to attract businesses to Illinois, you have to have cultural and natural kinds of resources that make Illinois a place that people want to come to.
Yeah, and he helped in Springfield. He helped restore the Dana Thomas House, or at least make that a priority for the state. And of course, the Thompson Center, polarizing as it is one of the most distinctive architectural government buildings in the country, and possibly in the world, I would argue, right?
Another thing, Brian, this is Kirk. He cared greatly about the Department of Natural Resources. It was called Conservation at one point in time. Karen's the expert on it, but Jim Thompson loved our state parks. He loved eating fried chicken at the giant city state park. He loved going to Starved Rock. Jim Thompson really put a lot of money into our state parks. He could have been the governor of Wisconsin with that kind of record and love for our state parks and outdoors.
If you're just joining us, we're revisiting a conversation I had in August following the death of former Illinois Governor Jim Thompson, reflecting on his life and legacy in office. I was joined by Karen Witter, who is an assistant to the governor for natural resources, and former state senator Kirk Dillard, who was legislative liaison for the governor. Karen, can you talk about how he came to policy decisions? I mean, he really got rolled up his sleeves and got personally involved in these issues, right?
What was interesting to me is that when it came to bills that had been passed by the legislature, he didn't act on those bills until he had the comprehensive bill file to review. So once the legislature went home, the staff were really busy conducting all of these bill reviews. Kirk and I would be on bill review teams together with agencies, and there would be a comprehensive review of what are the policy implications, the budgetary implications, how much is it going to cost, who's for it, who's against it, who proposed it in the legislature. And he understood all of those when he made decisions. And so more so than about anybody I can think of, and certainly in terms of what we see today in politics, he made informed decisions. Sometimes politics of the moment won the day, sometimes it was a policy issue, sometimes it was a budgetary issue, but he knew the whole range of issues when he made decisions. And if you put something in a bill review or a briefing paper, it better be right, because if it was on page 12, you might be hearing about it coming out of what he would say.
You know, Kirk, last week I was talking to a former state legislator who told me Thompson was a master deal maker and almost agnostic to philosophical differences. I wonder if you share that view or think that's a fair description of him.
It is. I wouldn't say he was completely agnostic. He did have fiscal principles that he adhered to. When he was governor, we generally had a AAA state credit rating. So, you know, he had some fiscal constraints. It's interesting, as I watch a lot of battles over capital projects, Jim Thompson would pretty much rely on the recommendations of experts. When he was governor, the Illinois Board of Higher Education's list of capital projects for the U of I, and the U of I did very well because of Senator Stanley Weaver, the legendary majority leader who I sat next to for about 10 years in the state Senate. Jim Thompson clearly, had his fiscal priorities, but he would get as far as he could from a Republican standpoint. And then he would start to compromise and, was a master negotiator who hated to not get things done or get things passed by the legislature.
You know, Kirk, when you ran for governor in the post-Blagojevich election of 2010, in my memory, I remember you sort of pitching yourself as a sort of a return to Thompson-like reasonableness and competence in governing Illinois. I wonder, what does it say about Illinois voters and the state that maybe we have not had another governor quite like that, you know, at least in recent decades?
Well, Jim Thompson had no enemies. You know, today's in politics, he taught me that, you know, today's adversary could be your biggest ally 4 years from now. Jim Thompson was a man who only saw the goodness in people. He had, as I said, no enemies. And he was a gentleman, a true gentleman. And that is so lost in today's rough and tumble political world. Jim Edgar, who I was the chief of staff for, you know, was a gentleman as well, but had a different style than Thompson. But Thompson was a roll up your sleeves. We're going to not get out of this room until we have a deal type of negotiator. And then working for Jim Thompson was fun. Let me tell you, you know, Karen or any of us who worked for Jim Thompson, we had a blast. We had Willie Nelson around at the state fair. Governor Thompson would go down that giant slide. So it was fun. You know, was he an agnostic? He clearly was flexible, had his fiscal principles, but he hated not to get the deal done. When you wanted something done, you went to Jim Thompson because he could generally deliver.
Kirk Dillard is the chairman of the RTA, former state legislator and legislative liaison for Governor Jim Thompson. We've also been speaking with Karen Witter, who is assistant to the governor, Jim Thompson, for natural resources. Thank you both so much for joining us and sharing your memories of Governor Thompson. Coming up after the break, we'll continue to remember those who died in 2020 with a conversation about the late Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And we remember singer-songwriter John Prine, who was originally from Maywood, Illinois, and walked a postal route here, where he got some inspiration for some of his songwriting. This is The 21st. Stay with us. This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're continuing to revisit some of our favorite conversations from 2020. Today, talking about people who died this year. On September 18th, U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg died. We began our remembrance of her with this clip from her confirmation hearing in 1993. She was answering a question from then-Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Joe Biden.
May I leave you, Mr. Chairman?
I mean, if you'd like to answer it more fully, I'm
just two thoughts that you can think about in between now and our next round. But but one of them was prompted by Senator Mosley Braun when she reminded us that the spirit of liberty must lie in the hearts of the women and men of this country. It would be really easy, wouldn't it, to appoint platonic guardians who would rule wisely for all of us, but then we wouldn't have a democracy, would we? We cherish living in a democracy. And we also know that this Constitution did not create a tricameral system. Judges must be mindful of what their place is in this system and must always remember that we live in a democracy that can be destroyed if judges take it upon themselves to rule as platonic guardians.
Following Justice Ginsburg's death, we spoke with someone who worked closely with RBG. David Franklin is a law professor at DePaul College of Law in Chicago, where he teaches constitutional law, administrative law, and conflict of laws. He was also Solicitor General of Illinois, basically the state's top appellate lawyer, from 2016 to 2019. But more on point for our conversation, he was a law clerk to Justice Ginsburg in 1999 and 2000. Here now is that conversation. David Franklin, let me first offer my condolences and say welcome to the 21st.
Thanks, Brian, and good morning to you and your listeners.
Good morning. So can you recall for us the first time you met Justice Ginsburg or heard from her? I think, you know, those of us who have never been Supreme Court clerks, it's a bit mysterious how that process works.
Sure. The first time I met her was in my clerkship interview with her, which happened to be on my 30th birthday. I was a little bit older, I suppose, than most of the young people who apply for clerkships, having taken some time after college and so forth. But that was it. That was the first time that we had ever met. I had sent in my resume and my application and my references and so forth. And I guess it piqued her interest and she wanted to meet me. So we had a nice conversation for about half an hour. And that was that.
What was your first impression of her?
Well, I was told, or maybe warned ahead of time by many people that I spoke to who had either clerked for her or knew her in some capacity, that she was a very soft-spoken, quiet, rather retiring person. You could hear a little bit of it in the clip that you played just before I came on. She had a way sometimes of pausing for long periods of time right in the middle of a sentence. And so all of my people told me, just don't fill the space. Just wait the wait it out. Let the pause go through, you know, which is, I'm sure, would be dead air on radio.
Believe it or not, that is one of the things they tell us is let people fill their own silences. So that
you
didn't want to interrupt the justice.
but in her own way, she was also very warm and easy to talk to. She didn't really want to talk about deep legal questions on that occasion. You know, she had sort of heard from my recommenders and so forth. And I think at that point, you know, in a job interview, often the potential boss just wants to make sure that you don't have three heads and, you know, that you're a person that they could get along with in the office. And so we made small talk, and it was very pleasant.
That's interesting, because I've heard one of the stories I've seen is that she was not one to make small talk very much. What was it like day to day working for her?
So once I was working for her, I think there wasn't very much small talk. She was all business in that sense. She was a relatively formal person, not the kind of boss who would stop by your desk or the water cooler and shoot the breeze. She liked to communicate through written memoranda or often through voicemail. I would often get voice messages from her that were time-stamped, you know, 1 or 2 in the morning, because she used to come into the office maybe around 11 or noon, and then work through the afternoon and then make sure that she got home in time for one of the amazing home-cooked dinners that her husband Marty prepared. And then she would work reading briefs and constructing arguments and drafting opinions deep into the night. And she would often leave a message saying, David, paragraph 2 on page 17, the arguments are in the wrong order. You know, something very, very specific. She was very detail-oriented and very thorough.
Yeah. You know, she famously, there have been also stories that, you know, a Super Bowl parade from the Washington football team was once marching past the Supreme Court, and she asked another clerk, this is something I read online, you know, what all the ruckus was, and he said the Super Bowl, and her response was reportedly, what's the Super Bowl? Just not one for...
That sounds apocryphal.
It does. Okay.
To me, but
okay.
I don't think she was a big sports fan. That's for sure. But her sport was called opera.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask you about. I'm glad you mentioned that. I've heard many clerks got to go to the opera, or maybe, depending on one's perspective, had to go to the opera with her. Were you one of
I
the lucky?
I think I was in the second category.
Okay.
Yes.
What did you see?
It was her one little bit of forced cultural education, you could say. The four of us clerks who were working for her go with her, I believe, to the Kennedy Center, and we saw Tosca, which is, of course, one of the great operas, and I must say it was lost on me.
But she did have a sense of humor, right? It could be, I'm not sure what word to use here, sly or subtle or dry at times.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. She often liked to sort of kibitz with you if you happened to be sitting next to her at an event or a reception. Just kind of give her views on the goings on. She was very funny, actually. It's just that the world didn't get to see that very often. And I think she took her public role very seriously. So, you know, it one of the wonderful things about her life was her many decades of marriage to Marty Ginsburg, which is dramatized in a feature film that came out recently. And he was hilarious and gregarious and often slightly outrageous and the life of the party. And that sort of allowed her to hang back a little bit more, and just they complemented each other really beautifully.
If you're just tuning in, we're revisiting a conversation we had in September following the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. We were joined by former RBG law clerk David Franklin, who worked with her in 1999 and 2000. Franklin now teaches constitutional law at DePaul College of Law in Chicago. David, what were some of the standout cases during your time working for Justice Ginsburg?
We had a lot of them. We had the first so-called partial birth abortion case. We had a case about whether the FDA could regulate cigarettes. We had several important First Amendment cases. I'm probably forgetting some, but it was a jam-packed year. There wasn't any one absolute blockbuster case, but we had many, many important.
I would say you missed Bush versus Gore by one term, I think, right?
I missed Bush versus Gore by about 6 months, and I'm very glad I did.
Well, how would you describe her judicial philosophy, right? We have these competing schools out there you hear about, originalist or textualist is another flavor of that, and then you have the active constitution. Did she subscribe to a particular mode of constitutional interpretation, or did she have a different approach?
I think she had a much more pragmatic case-by-case approach. I don't think she was very interested in signing on to large theories. She obviously had her special interests. You know, she was, if she had never been on the Supreme Court, she would still be regarded as the single most important advocate in our justice system for women's equality because of all the things that she did before she became a judge. So obviously that issue was near and dear to her heart. But even there, I think there's an insight to be gained about how she thought about these sorts of things, because she was very outspoken about the fact that Roe versus Wade, for example, was, in her view, correctly decided. She was a passionate believer in reproductive rights as a protected right under the Constitution, but she didn't think that it needed to be protected in sort of broad, abstract, gauzy, freedom-based terms. She saw it as a much more practical issue about the ability of women to participate in equal terms, on equal terms, in American society and in our economy. And so for her, it was a straightforward, practical issue of gender equality. So she viewed things in a very practical way. And she was very interested, Brian, in the facts of each case. She cared about how the case had been tried in the trial court, what the procedural history of the case was, what the other judges who had already passed on the case had said about it, and tended to shy away from large pronouncements.
You know, I think Justice Ginsburg, popularly at least, is as well known for her dissents as for her majority opinions. I mean, a lot of the pop culture ephemera, which I want to get to that in a minute, but you know, there's I Dissent pins with her likeness on it. I wonder, from your perspective, is it a loss that her time on the court was an era of conservative ascendancy, conservative majorities?
Well, I certainly think so, because the fact that she was in dissent meant that she wasn't able to move the law in the direction that she favored, which also happens to be the one that I favor. So, you know, it's a the problem in those cases was that the majority was wrong.
I was just saying, did you ever get the sense that she felt she was out of time? Like, boy, wouldn't it have been great to be on the Warren Court or something like that? Or is that just not fanciful thinking that she engaged in?
That wasn't her way. She was a person, and she's spoken about, she spoke about this many times herself. She was a person who just put her head down and did the work. And she was not one for resentment or regret or looking backward. So she always played the cards that she was dealt. You know, when she was in law school and Marty became ill with cancer just at the time they had had their first child, and she needed to not only study for herself, but basically take notes for Marty because he couldn't physically go to class. So she was basically doing law school for two while being a mother of a young child. She just did it. You know, when she graduated law school and found that there were barriers placed in her way just because she was a woman, even though she had finished at or near the top of her class, she just persisted, to use the popular phrase, I guess, and broke through those barriers in her own way, which was slowly, carefully, step by step. When I arrived at the court as her law clerk, it was within the first week that I was there that she got her first cancer diagnosis with colorectal cancer. And that was during the summer. And she was determined to be on the bench that first Monday in October, ready to go. And she was. She was just an incredibly determined, resolute person.
You clerked for Justice Ginsburg years before the notorious RBG took off as a pop cultural phenomenon. Can you cast your memory back to 1999 and someone says to you, your boss is going to be portrayed on Saturday Night Live, available as a stuffed doll, and people will be getting tattoos of her? How does 1999 David Franklin respond to that?
I would have giggled. I mean, you know, she's, if you knew her, she's the last person in the world that you would ever think would become that kind of icon, because she was so shy and so retiring and also really fundamentally conservative with a small C in her approach to the law and in some ways to life. I mean, obviously she had a very liberal worldview in terms of the rights that she thought all people should enjoy. But the way that she went about pursuing that was never radical, and she never sought attention for herself. But, you know, I think her advent as a pop culture icon has several causes. Part of it was that her husband Marty died, and she had a decision to make about sort of how to move on from that. And I think she decided consciously, I never spoke with her about this, but my sense was that she decided consciously to step forward, to make more public appearances, to make more public statements, some of which were frankly somewhat controversial for a sitting Supreme Court justice. And then when Justice John Paul Stevens retired, which made her the senior liberal justice on the court, she was sort of placed in the role of speaking for that wing of the court more forcefully, and she embraced it. And then it just so happened that some young women were inspired by her and decided to meme her in that way. And I think she was tickled by it. I think she really kind of secretly enjoyed all of the attention.
Yeah. Last question, and this has just got to be a quick answer because we've got less than a minute left, but I came across an online bobblehead store accepting pre-orders for Justice Ginsburg doll. It's available two versions, smiling and serious. I mean, you knew her in a way her legions of admirers never could. So my question to you, which is the definitive Ginsburg, smiling or serious?
Smiling.
David Franklin was a clerk to Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg from 1999 to 2000. He's also a law professor at DePaul College of Law in Chicago. He was also Solicitor General of Illinois from 2016 to 2019. David Franklin, thank you so much for sharing your memories with us here on the 21st. And again, my condolences.
Thanks, Brian. Take care.
More to come on the 21st as we remember people who died this year. Next up is a conversation about singer-songwriter and honorary Illinois poet laureate John Prine. Stay with us. This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Among those we lost in 2020 was acclaimed singer-songwriter John Prine. He died April 7th owing to complications from COVID-19. Here he is singing Angel from Montgomery, a song he wrote that was made famous by Bonnie Raitt.
Make me an angel that flies from Montgomery. Make me a poster of an old rodeo.
Following John Prine's death in April, Governor J.B. Pritzker named him the Honorary Poet Laureate of Illinois, the first person to receive that honor posthumously. Prine was originally from Maywood, Illinois, and worked as a mailman, which inspired his songwriting. To remember John Prine, his work, and his legacy, we spoke with journalist Eddie Huffman, who wrote the biography John Prine, In Spite of Himself. Here now is that conversation. Eddie, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Eddie, I want to begin with, how would you describe John Prine and his songwriting for people who may not be familiar? And how do you think he'll be remembered?
Well, he's been remembered quite a bit already. He's really gotten a lot of a lot of attention from his peers, from fellow songwriters. He was a well-loved man and songwriter. He was very earthy songwriter, very down to earth. Wrote about ordinary people, as Angel from Montgomery that you just played is a classic example of that. Wrote about ordinary lives. Had a great sense of humor. Some real pathos in some of his songs. Sam Stone is a classic example of this, really sort of tragic, very moving song about a Vietnam veteran struggling after coming home from the war. He had a good range, but coming from a very, rootsy sort of country folk background. that's sure. A start.
So as someone who's written about him, a biography on him, I imagine you spend a lot of time with Prine, at least if not physically, but, in the mental space with him.
Yeah.
I wonder, what was your reaction to hearing that he had been named Honorary Poet Laureate of Illinois?
I thought it was well-deserved. And it's nice to see someone, again, someone sort of a man of the people getting an award like that. He was not a great student. He didn't go to college. He was not a scholar, incredibly talented, wonderful songwriter, and grew up in Maywood, as you mentioned. His dad was a union man at the can factory in Maywood. Family all moved up from Kentucky because of greater job opportunities during the Depression, and so it's nice to see someone from that sort of blue collar background getting such a high honor, I think.
Mm-hmm. So you just mentioned that he grew up in Maywood, and his life in Illinois factors into his songwriting. One of those songs is Bruised Orange. Let's listen to the first verse of that.
My heart's in the ice house, come a hill or come down. Like a long ago Sunday, when I walked through the alley on a cool winter's morning to a church house just to shovel some snow. I heard sirens on the train track, how naked getting neutered. An altar boy's been hit by a local commuter just from walking with his back turned to the train that was coming so slow. You can gaze out the window, get mad and get madder, throw your hands in the air, say what does it matter, but it don't do no good to get angry, so help me, I know.
So what can you tell us about Bruised Orange and the story behind that song?
It's very autobiographical. He was an altar boy at a local church. It was walking distance from his house in Maywood, and that was just a scene he witnessed going to shovel snow at the church one day. There was another kid, I think roughly his age, had been hit by a train, and he wrote about it and very poignantly wrote about sort of the expressions on the faces of the mothers who weren't sure if it was their kid who had been hit by the train. So the song goes other places. It's sort of the song is also related to his first divorce, but that first verse especially was definitely inspired by his life in Maywood.
So let's talk about his early life in Maywood. You mentioned he was an altar boy. What else do we know about his time there?
Like I said, he was not a great student, but was obviously, you know, an incredibly talented wordsmith and a real thinker, thought a lot about characters and stories, which was kind of his real strength, I think, in school. As such, he was also a gymnast, actually. There's a great photo of him doing the pommel horse as a gymnast at Proviso East High School in Maywood. And he came from a musical family. His brother Dave played fiddle, and I think his mother played guitar. I'm not sure all the family connections, sure. But there were a lot of family from Kentucky that played instruments and that had traveled with him. His father, I don't think, played music, but was a huge country music fan. They would go see fans in the city. I mean, go see concerts in the city. His brother would take him to see people like Doc Watson. So he grew up with a lot of traditional music.
Well, and I understand when he was 14, he went to the Old Town School of Music in Chicago. When did he start actually first playing music himself?
Not too long before that. I don't remember exactly, but he got a guitar for Christmas one year when he was, around that age. And his brother, I think, taught him his first few chords. And then he went to the Old Town School and took some of the group classes there to learn more about playing guitar, and continued with those classes for several years, I think.
If you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're replaying a conversation I had this summer about songwriter John Prine. He died in April from complications related to COVID-19. In June, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker honored Prine posthumously by naming him the Poet Laureate of the state. This is a conversation we had with journalist and biographer Eddie Huffman, who wrote the book John Prine, In Spite of Himself. Okay, we talked a little bit about his time growing up in Maywood, which, of course, is a Chicago summer, and you said he wasn't a great student. As I understand it, he was kind of a daydreamer, right, which is maybe one of the reasons he was drawn to songwriting and his work as a mailman. Did that allow his mind to wander a bit as he wrote songs and sort of write songs as he's going about his mail route?
So he said, yeah, I think he gave him a lot of time, a lot of time to think. It's fairly, there's a lot of time just sort of roaming the streets when you're delivering mail. So not a real mentally taxing kind of work. And he wrote, I'm trying to think, I know Hello in There was one that he wrote a good bit just while he was out walking his mail route. He said he would stop in relay boxes, which are where they would transfer mail, like a truck would drop off some mail for someone on walking the street to pick up, that sort of thing. He would, on cold days, he would hide in those relay boxes and work on his songs. So yeah, that, and just what he saw, dogs chasing him down the street and delivering Reader's Digest inspired the song "Your Flag Decal Won't Get You Into Heaven Anymore." So yeah, the experience, it gave him plenty of time to think and write in his head, and the things he saw on the mail route certainly inspired some of his early songs.
Okay, well, you just mentioned a moment ago, Hello in There. Let's take a listen to that song.
Don't matter anymore. You know that old trees just grow stronger and old rivers grow wilder. Just grow lonesome, waiting for someone to say hello in there.
So what about this song reflects his time in Illinois? Can you expound on that a little bit?
Yeah, that actually came from an earlier delivery job. He had a newspaper route, and he would deliver papers to the Baptist retirement home in Maywood. And he said that the residents of the retirement home would treat him like a grandchild. They'd always want him, come in and talk, want him to come into the rooms and talk to them and that sort of thing. And that was a big part of the inspiration for writing Hello in There. It was just, his feelings for older people. And that also, another angle there with Maywood was his grandparents lived with the family in Maywood. And so he was around old people a lot as a child, and all that sort of factored into writing the song Hello in There.
So you mentioned he was taking music lessons in Chicago. He becomes part of the Chicago folk scene playing music. Is this while he's a mail carrier still?
Yeah, there was definitely some overlap. It took him a long time to really think of himself as a real songwriter and professional musician. He always just saw it as sort of a hobby. He would say he made up songs. He wouldn't say I write songs, I make up songs. And he actually sort of took a dare and got up at an open mic night one night in Old Town, and that led to his first paying gig as a musician. And he did, do the paying gigs and deliver mail for a time, but then realized that he could make just as much or more money with the music gigs as he was making delivering mail. So he dropped the mail route as soon as he figured that out.
So as we're, coming in toward the end of our conversation here, I mean, not even if people maybe don't realize they're fans or they weren't fans of John Prine's music in particular, there's a good chance that he probably influenced some of the artists that people do like. Can you talk about some of the people who cite him as an influence?
Oh, well, you mentioned Bonnie Raitt and played a version of Angel from Montgomery that he did with her. She was certainly influenced by John and a big good friend of his, very close to him through his life. But tons of people down through the years. There's a real major crop of current songwriters that cite him as an influence. Jason Isbell, Hayes Carl, Margo Price, Kelsey Walden, who actually signed to his record label shortly before he died. The list goes on and on and on. It's almost hard to know. It's almost easier to find sort of modern Americana singers who were not influenced by Prine than who were. It's just such a huge list of people who cite him as an influence these days.
Sure. And of course, one of the best known names who does is probably Bob Dylan, who has been quoted as saying, "Prine stuff is pure Proustian existentialism, Midwestern mind trips to the nth degree." Can you talk about Dylan's appreciation of Prine's music?
Yeah, they were actually they spent a little time together, and Dylan reportedly recorded a couple of Prine songs, but they've never surfaced. There's a story I tell in the book about when Dylan and Prine and Steve Goodman all got together with Kris Kristofferson at Carly Simon's apartment, if I have the story right, in New York. It was some combination like that, and Steve Goodman, Prine's good friend, also from Chicago, was a real smart aleck, and he apparently said made some smart remarks to Dylan in the course of the conversation. But Dylan really, really respected Prine, as that quote shows, and there was a mutual admiration society there for sure.
And so you wrote about it, as you mentioned a moment ago, he sort of had took a long time to see himself as a songwriter. How did his career end? I mean, obviously we know how his life ended, unfortunately, is complications from COVID-19. But what was this, he had definitely arrived by the time that came about, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. He signed to a major label, Atlantic Records, when he was only 23 years old, if memory serves. And, was on a series of major labels before he started his own label, Oh Boy Records, in the early 1980s. And probably his biggest hit record came out in the early 90s, The Missing Years, that sold about 250,000 copies at that time. He never had any hit singles under his own name, though Don Williams and George Strait both had big country hit singles that he co-wrote. He was a huge influence on a lot of people, even though he was never sort of a radio star in his own right. His work is very well known.
We have been speaking with Eddie Huffman, author of the biography John Prine, In Spite of Himself. Eddie, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, Brian.
And that is all the time we have for today. Before we go, I do want to urge you to join our texting group. We hear interesting things from listeners. It informs our coverage. You can join by texting the word TALK, that's T-A-L-K, to 217-803-0730. Again, just send the word TALK to 217-803-0730. You can also stay up to date with us on Twitter. Just search for The 21st. We are at 21STShow. That's 21STShow. We're also on Facebook at The 21st. all those links, every other way to get in touch with us. You can leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us on social media. It's all at our website, which is 21stshow.org. We've got all of our past shows there, and you can find us most places you get your podcasts. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and NPR One. Just search for The 21st. Our program is produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Our interns are Zainab Qureshi, Brielle Skullark, and Chantel Vaca. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thank you to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.